It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, ISIS released a second execution video yesterday. We'll talk to a foreign policy expert about how the United States could respond.
First, the race for governor is swinging into high gear in Wisconsin, and the biggest issue at play for Governor Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Mary Burke is jobs.
Scott Walker ran his last campaign with a promise of creating 250,000 jobs in the state in his first term. He's probably not going to meet that goal. Said yesterday he's not going to issue another jobs goal for a potential second term.
That hasn't stopped him from promoting the growth that Wisconsin has seen during his first term. According to a recent ad from the Walker campaign, Wisconsin ranks third in the Midwest for job growth.
Mary Burke, on the other hand, is telling voters that the state hasn't seen enough growth during Walker's time in office. She's using her experience as a businesswoman as a qualification for growing the state's economy. In a recent ad from her campaign, she claimed that Wisconsin ranks dead last for job creation.
So the question is, who's right? Is Wisconsin third or dead last in the Midwest for job growth?
Here with us now to help fact check is Jessie Apoyan. She's a reporter for the Capital Times. Jessie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start things out by checking out each of the ads in turn. We'll start with the one from the Mary Burke campaign.
He made a pledge.
250,000 new jobs by the end of our first term in office.
And asked us to hold him to it.
Is this a campaign promise? Something you want to be held to?
Absolutely.
Today, Wisconsin is dead last in Midwest job growth. 10th out of 10.
Wisconsin lags behind most of the country when it comes to job growth.
And those 250,000 jobs? Not even close. Broken promises? Dead last in jobs. Scott Walker's not working for you.
An ad from the Mary Burke campaign. Now we'll turn to Governor Walker's campaign ad.
Hi, I'm Scott Walker. Well, the latest job numbers are in, and Wisconsin created more private sector jobs than Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Ohio, and Illinois. That means we rank third in the Midwest. Our opponent can try and mislead you and criticize the Wisconsin comeback. But that doesn't change the fact that we're moving Wisconsin forward. We won't stop until everyone who wants a job can find a job.
All right, Jesse, one ad says we're last in the Midwest. One ad says we're third in the Midwest. They can't both be right, can they?
Oddly enough, they kind of can. It seems like the only thing that these two agree on in these ads is what the definition of the Midwest is. But oddly enough, they are not necessarily wrong, either one of them. They're both using different sets of data coming from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Scott Walker's ad is using a monthly count, and Mary Burke's ad is using a quarterly count.
And it's a matter of which measure you choose and where you set the start and end point in a way, isn't
that? Exactly, it is. Governor Walker himself has said before that the quarterly count is the gold standard. It's the one that he encourages people to use when counting his 250,000 job pledge. He's used a number of different statistics over his time in office, though. He's used the monthly count that he's using now. He's used numbers from the Philly Fed. In the meantime, Mary Burke is using that gold standard. So the difference is the monthly count comes out more frequently, but it's less reliable. The quarterly count takes a little bit longer to come out, but it gives a steadier, more accurate picture of what's going on.
So that monthly report you said is more unreliable. How much data is it using, or how much of the overall picture, I guess, does it represent?
Sure. So the monthly count is an estimate based on a survey of about 3.5% of the state's employers. The quarterly count, I believe, goes to about 96%, so it's a little more complete.
But the tricky thing in a political environment where we in the media, the candidates almost fetishize these jobs reports, the quarterly report, we have to wait to get.
We do. We don't have to wait much longer for the next one. It's coming out in September. But because of that, the one that Mary Burke is using is a little bit older. Mm-hmm. So Scott Walker's not wrong to say he's got the latest numbers.
Right. But the latest numbers, they come out fast, but they may not tell us as much. And those are subject usually, as I recall, to revisions over the next couple months afterward.
They are, yep. Yeah. It does take a few months to solidify what comes out from that. And, from month to month, you can have a lot of changes. It's a little more volatile.
Well, I don't want to get too philosophical here, but when we look at two ads drawing from different data, coming to different conclusions, what is truth?
That's an excellent question. I've looked at both a little bit. PolitiFact has also looked at both. They didn't give much help. They give Governor Walker's claim a mostly true rating and Mary Burke's a true. So I guess if you want to give her a little edge on that. The end game here, though, is maybe not to give too much credit or blame to the governor in any case for how much effect that that person has on the job creation in the state.
Right. That's an issue people have been bringing out since Governor Walker's initial pledge to create that many jobs. How much ability does a governor have to make jobs happen in the private sector? What have you looked at on there?
So talking to a couple of economists, I think the general consensus is the governor doesn't have a huge impact necessarily on the most current job numbers. That person can be an advocate for the business climate in the state, and to the extent that the legislature is willing to cooperate, the governor can even influence policy a little bit, but those policies take a while to show their effect. Meanwhile, the state economy is driven a lot more by what's going on nationally, what's going on globally, the whims of consumers, even the weather.
And yet it seems like the campaigns have agreed, and a lot of voters probably too, that jobs and the economy of Wisconsin are the big issue. This is the voting issue, whether or not the governor has that much to do with it.
It absolutely is. The most recent Marquette poll shows us that these ads are maybe even affecting the way voters are looking at the job picture in the state. From July to August, the number of voters or the percentage of registered voters who said that the state is lagging in job growth went up about 5%. So it's about half of registered voters who think that. But at the same time, they can't really agree on one candidate who might have the answer to that. They were split evenly between Governor Walker and Mary Burke on which candidate as governor would do better at creating jobs.
So when you ask people who they're going to vote for, they seem to be split really evenly. And you say there's the same split there in who people think would do a better job on the deciding issue for them.
Right, which I guess is not a surprise.
So what it keeps coming back to is this is a close election, it sounds like.
This is an incredibly close election. We've got differences between more, likely voters are favoring Mary Burke, registered voters are favoring Governor Walker, but it's all within the margin of error. It's all within a couple percentage points.
From all these different statistics, the quarterly census and the monthlies in particular, when you talk to economists about these things, did they give a sense that there was an overall picture of how Wisconsin is doing in the economic recovery?
Sure. And it, once again, it varies a little bit. In terms of the most recent months, yes, Wisconsin has had a sizable percentage increase compared to other states. But looking over the terms that Governor Walker has been in office, starting the quarter before he took office, Wisconsin is lagging, not just in the Midwest, but throughout the nation, sitting in about 35th place, I want to say, for that.
And you, as you just mentioned, the Marquette poll, do I have this right? There's a growing perception, a slowly growing perception, that the jobs are lagging in Wisconsin?
Yes, that's right.
So what do you look at next? What things that the governor and his opponent are claiming are you trying to evaluate now when it comes to jobs and the economy?
Well, we'll certainly be looking at those new quarterly numbers when they come out later this month. I think that's going to be a huge indication of the broader picture. Like I said, that those numbers paint a more stable picture of what's going on. They've also each released plans on what they would do. Governor Walker just said recently he wouldn't make that same jobs pledge in a second term. And Mary Burke's got a plan that touches a lot on the rural economies and what she would do for that. So I think they're going to continue to be pressed on the specifics of those plans that they've released.
And as we see ads either touting positive performance or attacking negative performance, does anybody have a sense, as we look at the Marquette poll over time, that it's moving the needle, that it's changing the way anybody thinks of one candidate or the other?
In a small way, it might be, yes, but probably not a ton necessarily. Like I said, while more people do think that the state is lagging, that probably indicates that they're listening to Mary Burke's ad, but it doesn't necessarily swing that support a whole lot toward then thinking that she would be the candidate to do that. At the same time, the numbers of voters who think that the state is doing better is also going down. So you would think, in conjunction with that, their opinion of the governor might also be on its way down.
We're talking to Jessia Poyen. She's a reporter for the Capital Times, talking about Governor Scott Walker's claim that Wisconsin ranks third in the Midwest when it comes to job growth. His Democratic challenger, Mary Burke, says it ranks last. And our guest says, depending on which set of data you look at, they're both kind of right.
And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Governor Walker's numbers are a monthly count and Mary Burke's quarterly. Which numbers do you trust more? And how do you think Wisconsin is doing compared with other states in the Midwest? Is job growth, do you think, going to be the most important factor when you vote this fall? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're back with Jessie O'Poyan. She's a reporter for the Capital Times, and we're talking about the dueling ads in the race for governor. Governor Walker's claim that Wisconsin ranks third in the Midwest for job growth. Democratic challenger Mary Burke says it ranks dead last, and depending on which data you use, which report, they both have a case to make.
And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Are jobs the big issue here in the midterm election? Is that going to decide your vote for governor? Let us know what you think. And do you have particular confidence in either candidate to lead the Wisconsin economy? Why is that? Why do you choose one over the other? 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to Bruce with us in Madison. Bruce, hi.
Hi. I just have a brief comment for you. Governor Walker's pledge of to create $250,000 jobs didn't come out of the clear blue. That's a number that an economist who I heard on public radio suggested would be Wisconsin would gain over 4 years in a normal economic recovery. We haven't had a normal economic recovery, but I'd suggest that Governor Walker really can't take any credit for creating any jobs.
Bruce, thanks for the call. And that's one thing we haven't gotten into as much so far, Jessie. Apart from the job growth and where we rank in the Midwest, the governor's promise creating 250,000 jobs, as Bruce was saying, that might have could have happened by natural growth in a healthy economy. But that is a big part of ads directed at him, including the ad we listened to earlier from the Burke campaign.
It is, yeah. And he has been asked about it recently. Of course, the ad that she's put up is playing a clip of him saying that, yes, absolutely, he wants to be held to that promise for 250,000 jobs. But more recently, he said, you know, hey, I made a bold promise. I wanted to set our sights high. And, you know, he doesn't necessarily regret that, even if we don't make it. And he doesn't think that voters are going to hold that against him.
Is this a theme you think we'll see coming back again and again in Mary Burke's ads between now and November?
I wouldn't be surprised if we saw more of it. I mean, it's just, you know, it's too good to take a promise that someone has made and has failed to make good on, regardless of what factors are at play in meeting that promise. That's something that she can continue to use.
Bruce, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Rick with us in Kenosha. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think of this?
Well, there was a claim made by Mr. Obama, if I recall, during the stimulus debate of his first term, that if we didn't pass the stimulus, that unemployment would see 10%. Congress passed the stimulus, plus, if I remember correctly, another 100 bill or so beyond that. And yet unemployment still went to 10%. What does this say about politicians of any stripe making these claims? And what does it say about voters that buy into it? I mean, to me, she touched on this earlier, that the governor of a state this size cannot do a whole lot in the context of an economy, national economy, that is just sputtering. So, like, what's the point of any of this?
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. It's a dangerous game for politicians of any party, Jessie, putting concrete numbers on what they're going to accomplish.
Yeah, it definitely is. And, you know, like we talked about earlier, a governor may not have that much of an effect on how many jobs the state actually creates, especially in the private sector. So, yes, it's a dangerous game to try to set a concrete number.
Do you see, we'll get back to jobs and the economy, do you see any other issue coming to the forefront? I mean, obviously we can be surprised, but is there anything percolating out there that you think would be as big a deal between now and Election Day as the jobs issue?
I don't think anything bigger, no. I mean, the same things continue to come up. The John Doe cases have been talked about, but I don't think that's going to change anyone's opinion necessarily one way or another. You know, things like education, women's health, those are things that people talk about. But I think jobs is really the driving issue here.
Thanks a lot for the call, Rick. We'll go now to Luke with us in Fremont. Luke, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What do you think about all this?
Well, I just wanted to throw a comment out there. I'm a carpenter from the Fox Valley area, Appleton, Oshkosh, and I've been working for about 10 years there at this company, and it's been our busiest last year and a half since I started. We haven't been able to keep up with demand. We've doubled the size of our company in the last 2 years or last year and a half. And it seems like that's, I mean, all the lumber companies, all the contractors have a hard time finding people to do the work. There's just so much out there for new construction and new housing. So it's there's no end in sight, really. They're all predicting that next year is going to be just as crazy.
Luke, congratulations for you and your business. Do you chalk this up to a general recovery? Do you think it's something specific that's happening in Wisconsin, maybe something the governor has done?
I like the governor, so I tend to just think that some of his policies work towards that, but I guess I can't say that anything he's done specifically helps the construction industry, so it might just be pent-up aggression or pent-up building from the last, you know, couple years where people weren't building. But I guess I have an issue when I hear people say that they can't find jobs or that there's a hard time getting jobs. There may not be the job you want to get, but there is jobs available. You might just have to work somewhere you don't want to for a while before you can, you know, get the experience to move on and do something that you'd like to do.
Luke, thanks a lot for the call and sharing your perspective there. Luke's seeing signs of growth in his local economy and in his line of work, but he's careful to distinguish. He says he supports the governor in general, but doesn't think you can solidly connect the dots necessarily between the good news he sees and what the governor does.
Sure, and you know, we may well see more signs of growth come out in the next quarterly report, or we may not, but I mean, it is encouraging to hear a personal story like that.
I wonder if the ads are already written around that quarterly report. Either way, one side ready with the attack ad, one side ready to crow if the numbers are good.
Oh yeah, I'm sure they're thinking about it.
All right, back to our callers now. We've got John with us in Brookfield. John, hi. Are you there, John? No, I don't think John's there. We'll try Stephanie now in Sharon. Stephanie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Yes, I have a question about the data. I'm curious, the jobs that have been claimed to be added to Wisconsin, in what sector, in what job sector would they be, and what income brackets?
Oh, do those monthly and quarterly reports dig down that deep? I'm just not sure.
To be honest, I think in the quarterly ones do. I think the monthly ones do too. I don't have the data in front of me right now, but the Bureau of Labor Statistics would have that.
Okay, thanks. That's something we can look at in a future show, I think, Stephanie. And that's something that hasn't come up that much. The more nuanced discussion we've heard, in fact, on this show yesterday from the Center on Wisconsin Strategy with their annual report, trying to figure out. Okay, when you've got one job added, is it a minimum wage job? Is it a higher paying job? Do you think the political debate will get that complicated, or are we just going to be looking at raw numbers of jobs here?
It's really hard to get that nuanced and add when you've got a couple seconds to make three or four points, and you know, the ads may cite the sources that'll give you that kind of a nuanced answer, but it's not something we're going to see, probably.
Looks like we've got John in Brookfield back on the line. John, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thank you for getting me back on again. It was a cell phone tower issue. Look, the numbers that Mary Burke is putting out, I feel are disingenuous, because the first quarter that she starts measuring with were actually Doyle's numbers, because that's where the quarters come back from. And when you add to it the fact that Scott Walker had to fight himself through two elections, the job growth that he tried to promise is hard to meet when he's got one arm behind his back because he lost almost a year with a second recall. I really feel that a good measure of growth would be to go after his second election and to say, what has he done since then? But on top of that, you have to think, why would people want to come to the state of Wisconsin with jobs, with businesses, when they see this kind of hate going on between Democrats and Republicans?
Gotcha, John. Thanks for the call. So part of it is, where do you draw that starting line when we measure this in the ads?
And that's a really good question. And depending on which data you're looking at, that can make a huge difference. Although the economists that I did talk to have generally agreed, starting at the fourth quarter of 2010 and going until the most recent fourth quarter is a fairly reliable estimate.
Jesse, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking to Jesse Apoyan of the Capital Times about dueling ads in the race for governor of Wisconsin.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with the latest on the race for the Senate and demands from Congress for a more active role in response to the Islamic militant group ISIS.
First, a look at the latest action from that organization and its release of a video showing the beheading of another American journalist. The group calls the video a second message to America to stop airstrikes in Iraq. It shows the beheading of journalist Stephen Sotloff, the second journalist killed by the terrorist group.
Jeremy Suri is with us now to talk about how the U.S. could respond to these messages. He's the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs, History, and Public Policy at the University of Texas Austin and the LBJ School of Public Affairs. His latest book is Liberty's Surest Guardian. Jeremy, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob. Nice to be on.
So one journalist, then another in these horrific videos, the threat in the latest video of another victim. Do you expect to see more and more videos like this from ISIS as long as the U.S. is involved there?
I expect that we'll see more of these videos in the coming weeks and months because they're having the effect that ISIS wants. They're drawing attention. They're scaring people. And they're making the foreign powers, including the United States, look somewhat weak and helpless. So I think we'll see more of these.
And there have been calls from some in Congress and elsewhere that the United States should step up efforts in Iraq in response and maybe in Syria against ISIS. What's in our toolkit? What can we do that we haven't been doing already?
Well, there are some things we can do, but we do have to begin, Rob, by recognizing there are limits on what we can do insofar as we don't want to send a large occupation army, and there are good reasons why we don't want to send a large occupation army to the region. And what we are trying to do, of course, is to use air power and allies on the ground to turn the tide against ISIS, to contribute to their defeat on the battlefield and they're being forced out of the areas they're occupying. It does seem to me there are a few additional things we could do. We can certainly try to share more intelligence that we have on where members of ISIS are with other groups on the ground. We're often hesitant to share intelligence because we don't know how they're going to use it. And I think we can also probably do a better job of warning Americans to get out and other civilians to get out of these areas. But once Americans and others are captured, there are very limited things we can do, and it's generally not a good strategy to try to go in and just bomb random areas because we don't actually know where the hostages are being held in many cases.
The president has said anything short of boots on the ground, but there's pressure out there for some kind of a response. Is there some way we might find ourselves starting with airstrikes, then more advisors, and kind of backing into a land conflict?
Well, there certainly is a lot of historical precedent for that, Rob, as you know. So that's certainly a possibility. We should also acknowledge that we already have put new boots on the ground when we send in special operations forces to try to rescue people or when we send in special operations forces to train fighters on the ground. Both of those are things we're doing now. We are actually putting more boots on the ground. So we are doing some of that. I think there's a very strong prohibition in American politics today against a large commitment of American ground troops. So I don't foresee that happening in the next few weeks and months, but I do expect we'll see escalating American efforts from the air with small insertions of force of our own and aiding other groups, particularly Middle Eastern groups that we're working with, including the Iranians, to do some of this for us, especially in Iraq.
Well, the strategy seems to be to provide the air support side of the equation for Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, for the Iraqi army, such as it is. Is that enough to tip the balance for those ground forces already there, already with a stake in defeating ISIS, to help turn the tide on the Iraqi side of the equation?
No, it's certainly not, because if those forces on the ground were adequate to start with, and if they were organized appropriately and had popular support on the ground, you wouldn't see ISIS rising this way. The best way to understand the rise of ISIS is to focus for a second less on the extremism of the group and more on the power vacuum that's been created. What you've had through parts of Iraq and now Syria and parts of Yemen and elsewhere is a collapse of organized political authority, rampant corruption and factionalism, some of which we have contributed to unintentionally. And that's opened up a space similar to what happened with the Taliban after the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan in the late 1980s. That ISIS is filling, and airstrikes are not going to create order on the ground. They're going to make it harder for ISIS to expand. But if we really want to see the tide turned, there has to be an organized, compelling force on the ground to do this. And it better not be Americans, because that's only going to reinforce the extremism that we're seeing there.
As complicated as things are in Iraq, they're more complicated maybe in Syria. We don't know who we would be bombing ISIS to help, it seems like.
Right. Well, we're in a terrible situation in Syria in that we, for very good reasons, want to see Bashar Assad step down. But the ISIS forces are the ones fighting him in many cases, or they're one of the dominant forces fighting him. So if we take action against ISIS in Syria, which it looks like the president will do, we are helping Assad's case. If we support Assad, then we're helping the person we want, the person who used chemical weapons, the person we want to see leave power. It's also complicated because the Iranians in Syria are supporters of Assad's. So although we might be working with them in Iraq, it's hard to work with them in Syria. The best option for us in Syria, it seems to me, is to try to find anti-Assad forces that are not necessarily committed to ISIS or might be working with ISIS, but might be willing to pursue a different agenda. But I don't know if such forces really exist.
It seems like the only thing that could defeat ISIS there is if everyone else agreed, okay, ISIS is the common enemy, let's stop fighting each other, let's stop trying to get, you know, our own best advantage out of this situation that ISIS is creating. Is there any chance of something like that happening?
Well, I think, Rob, that's one way ISIS gets defeated, but I think it depends what we mean by defeat. ISIS is not going to be able to govern effectively for the long term. They're a group of different factions that have come together out of convenience at this moment. What's likely to happen if they're not stopped in the short run is that they'll establish short-term authority in multiple areas. They'll continue to do horrific, truly horrific things, and then they'll start fighting among themselves. That shouldn't make us feel comfortable, though, because the worry we have, and this is one of the lessons of Afghanistan, is if they start doing what I just described, they might bring their fighting far beyond their own territory, including our territory. And so that's the concern we have. I'm not concerned about a long-term ISIS empire. What I'm concerned about, and I think what most people in Washington are concerned about, is that ISIS in its internal expansion will, in the short run, bring horror not only to those on the ground, which is bad enough, but to those far away.
Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That was foreign policy expert Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas, Austin. His latest book is Liberty's Surest Guardian. He's with us to talk about the latest videos released by ISIS and what, if anything, the United States can do in response. It's time now for a weekly look at Congress. Yesterday, as we just heard, ISIS released the video of a second American journalist being beheaded. And as tension between the U.S. and ISIS rises, some legislators are calling for the president to ask for permission from Congress before advancing new offensives against the group.
And the fight over the Senate is heating up between Republicans and Democrats. A record-shattering $400 million in early money has been spent on the race, but it still appears to be in limbo. David Cannon is with us now. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison. David, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Well, let's start with the congressional response to ISIS. It seems as though there is some pressure to act there on the president and also Congress asking for a greater voice. How would you say it's going down?
Well, I think as with the response we've heard from all the critics of President Obama, there are a whole range of critiques that are coming from Congress right now. And there's no single voice of what should be done there other than to say that they agree that President Obama has failed in his foreign policy, at least on the Republican side of the House. Everyone is saying that we need to do something differently, but no one has a great alternative. And as your previous segment outlined, the situation with ISIS is incredibly complex, and there are really no easy answers that, you know, if we could, you know, bomb one part of their, you know, strongholds and have a good outcome, we would do that. But clearly that's not going to happen. That's not an easy answer. So the Republican critique, it ranges from those who, you know, want to send troops there to those who, you know, want to have, you know, more of a voice. But there's no coherent message coming from Congress right now other than just it's anti-Obama, basically.
Well, the president said last week that he didn't have a cohesive policy for how to deal with ISIS at the moment, and that seems to have ruffled a lot of feathers. Why do you think that was such a contentious thing to say?
Well, it was a contentious thing to say, but I think it was an honest thing to say. I don't think that anyone has the magic plan on how to solve the problem. And for those who want more aggressive action, you can just look at the ISIS response to the last round of bombing, which they themselves say is the reason for the second beheading, is that this is retribution for the bombing for the first beheading. And so if the goal is to stop ISIS from engaging in more terrorist acts like beheading journalists, then clearly there's no easy way to make that stop. And so I think Obama's admission that he did not have any clear plan here, on the one hand, sounds like you want stronger leadership coming from the White House. On the other hand, I think he's being straightforward with the American people that we just don't have any good solution right now.
Well, in the absence of that, some members of Congress are saying, you know what, we're going to grab the ball and start it rolling. What sorts of things are we hearing from foreign policy leaders in Congress?
Well, again, there's no single voice. I mean, John McCain the other day said that he does want a stronger response, and including potentially some more troops in Iraq. I think foreign policy leaders in Congress have a harder time agreeing is exactly what to do with Syria and how you address the ISIS problem in Syria, because that's wrapped up then, as your previous expert Jeremy Suri said, they're really anything you do to stop ISIS actually is going to help Assad, and so that's an additional complexity there.
Do you see all these disparate voices in Congress coming together and some sort of legislation coming forward in the absence of a White House plan?
It's possible but unlikely, because I think that it's not to have both the Republican House and the democratically controlled Senate come together with a single approach seems to me incredibly unlikely. I mean, the Congress right now is as dysfunctional as any time in recent memory, where the two houses of Congress really can't agree on much of anything. And, they can't even pass budgets in a timely way. So to get them to agree on complex foreign policy issues seems to me to be a real reach.
Do you see any danger in the pressure coming from Congress? You're saying it's sort of a muddled chorus of voices right now, but should those voices, do you think, reach a pitch where they will force the president's hand?
Well, that is certainly possible, and I think the fact that the public also seems to want to have some kind of stronger action here, I think there will be pressure on the president to do something. But his approach to this point has been to try to build coalitions, to try to get UN resolutions behind any kind of action, and that takes time. It takes time to put together alliances and in favor of a coherent policy, and so that works against any kind of quick action. So yes, there will be pressure from Congress. Whether or not that ends up forcing Obama's hand, or if he stays the course with his more cautious coalition-building approach, remains to be seen.
Now, does President Obama need congressional approval before taking further action against ISIS? We've seen airstrikes, but what about beyond that?
Well, of course, we have at least a 40-year debate on this, running back to the end of the Vietnam era and the War Powers Resolution, in terms of what the relative position of Congress and the president are in terms of sending troops. While the War Powers Resolution has been in effect for about 40 years now, presidents have always maintained their unilateral authority to use force what necessary to protect American interests. And Congress, while complaining about that bitterly for both Democratic and Republican presidents, they still generally go along with that presidential use of force. And so my sense is, if President Obama did eventually decide on a course of action, it would, while still having its critics in Congress, Congress would not be able to really stop those kinds of unilateral decisions by the president.
Well, let's turn to the battle now for the Senate. Now, the big question in these midterm elections is, will the Senate flip? Will the Republicans get control of the Senate? How would you answer that question right now?
Well, my favorite sort of prognosticator is Nate Silver, 538.com. He just came out with his midterm model that he's had for the last several years today. And he has a 63.9% chance of Republicans taking over control of the Senate right now. So, and his sort of modal prediction of, you know, his 10,000 simulations he does for his forecasting model has a 52-seat Republican Senate. Now, while that sounds like a pretty good edge for the Republicans, you know, 64-36 in terms of the probability of taking the Senate, when you dig a little deeper and look at the races, this is still really very much a toss-up kind of situation, because 16 of the 36 Senate races are too close to call right now in terms of the margin of error. And six of those are just, you know, razor thin and could go either way. And so while the Republicans certainly have an edge right now, and if the elections were held today, you know, indeed there's a pretty good chance they would take the Senate. But with that many races so close, this is still very much up for grabs.
And let's talk about the money being spent in this race. What are we looking at in terms of numbers?
We'll break all records for midterm elections, this election for sure, with, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars already being spent, and not only for the Senate, but also gubernatorial races around the country. The amount of outside money, this is a, you know, relatively new development for midterm elections. We've seen outside money in presidential elections for the last, you know, two, three presidential election cycles. But in a lot of congressional races now, for both the House and the Senate, you have outside money, that is money that's not being spent by the campaigns themselves, actually being greater than the amount of money being spent by the candidates. And so that's, again, a relatively new development in midterm elections, and it almost certainly will be a record amount of money this election cycle.
Now, as I understand it, there has been more money raised on the Republican side. Do you see that being the deciding factor, or do you expect more money to flow in later in the race to Democrats?
Well, right. The Republicans do have an edge right now, and often you see that advantage to the out party. So the party that's not controlling the White House, you know, typically has an advantage in midterm elections. The out party almost always picks up seats in midterm elections. Indeed, in the last 100 years, the only three exceptions to that were in 1934, in the middle of the Great Depression, 1998 with a backlash against the Clinton impeachment, and then in 2002. In the wake of the 9/11 attacks. So it has to be some pretty big, dramatic set of circumstances to not disadvantage the president's party. So the president's party is almost always disadvantaged. And we're seeing that play out in this midterm election for sure, both in terms of the, you know, the pickups the Republicans are likely to make, but also in terms of the money. And you see out parties, you know, generally having an advantage in raising money because contributors see this as a chance to, you know, pick up some seats.
Now, if we want to pay attention to the seats that are really the flashpoints of these midterms, what should we be watching? Where?
So the ones that everyone's looking at, I think, most closely are Iowa, Colorado, North Carolina, Alaska, Arkansas. Those are probably the top five of the really, you know, too close to call, coin flip kind of races. Then the next tier would include Georgia, Michigan, Louisiana would be probably the next ones that are at least, you know, relatively close. And so that's, and each of the top ones I mentioned, of those top six, each of those are right now leaning towards the Republicans, but just barely leaning towards the Republicans. And so, you know, a lot of things could change over the next couple of months to tilt that back to the Democrats' advantage. So let's say, you know, the economy continues to strengthen and we have a couple of good jobs reports in a row and economic activity picks up, consumer spending picks up. I think that would, you know, be enough to tip it back to the Democrats in some of these key races. If, on the other hand, you know, the economy slows down, the jobs numbers aren't quite as good over the next couple of months, then I think we're probably looking at a Republican Senate.
Now, going into this race, Republicans have been hoping that the narrative would be the Affordable Care Act and that, you know, if people are opposed to that, they would vote against Democrats in the midterms. That doesn't seem like it's turning out to be the prevailing narrative. So what is? Is it jobs, the economy, or is it, you know, maybe turning on something like foreign policy?
Well, midterm elections rarely turn on foreign policy. I mean, unless it's something like the 9/11 attacks that, you know, is really, you know, central to, you know, everyone's, you know, paying attention to that and everyone, you know, is aware of that. So it's unlikely to be foreign policy unless, of course, the situation really deteriorates in Syria and Iraq, and things, you know, get much worse, and we, you know, say end up having to send some troops in, you know, then that could become relevant in the midterm elections in a way that could be decisive. And so you're absolutely right that Obamacare has kind of receded as a important issue in these midterms, largely because it seems to be working better than the critics, you know, thought it would be at this point. More people are signing up, and so it's just not the same kind of a potent issue to use as it was, as it looked like it would be earlier this year when healthcare.gov was having all those problems online and people couldn't sign up and so on.
And we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
That was David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison. Paul Singer will be back with us for next week's On Congress.